Hey, good day, everybody. Welcome to another great podcast, OIG Roundtable. We're all here. I've got Jason Eisengrind. By the way, we're twinsies. We're wearing the same t-shirt today. This was not planned. While he was my mentor at the OIG, I don't call him every day and ask him what he's doing or what he's wearing. So I am joined by my compadres, Jason Eisengrind, retired senior executive from the OIG, and then the retired UPIC West director for the Medicare contractor over there. Wade McFowl, or Wade McFall, depending upon who you're talking to, retired assistant special agent in charge from the LA office of the OIG and is now one of our Medicaid subject matter experts on one of our Medicaid contracts. And Matt Kachansky, who is one of our managers here, also retired senior executive, was Jason's counterpart at the UPIC Northeast. And I am still Eric Rubenstein, the senior director of litigation, fraud, waste, and abuse support. Thanks again for tuning in. We appreciate everybody spending their time. So today we're going to start moving on, shifting a little bit of our focus away from a lot of the discussions that we typically have involving sort of the law enforcement, fraud, waste, abuse aspect. And we're talking a little bit more in the global payment integrity space. You know, we do a lot of work as an SIU, outsourced SIU here at Advise. And we do a lot of work involving some process improvement and things of that sort. And we're starting to learn a lot more about sort of the general landscape that's out there and the differences that exist and sort of that push-pull that exists in the SIU space between the need to make referrals to law enforcement under either state regulatory requirements, if you're a Medicaid provider or a Medicaid MCO, if you're a Medicare Advantage in the commercial space, you know, there are some requirements to make referrals to state law enforcement or regulatory, and that push-pull between making those referrals and also the recovery of dollars from a payment integrity perspective. So, you know, and that's always been the challenge. And so, Wade, I want to talk to you because, you know, you spent your career at the OIG, and then you come over and you're now on an SIU in the Medicaid space for one of our contracts. And you see this push-pull really firsthand that, you know, you've got a mindset, the law enforcement mindset of I'm identifying fraud. I should be making referrals for fraud with the push-pull of, but there's also this requirement to recover dollars and sort of those challenges. And so let's talk a little bit about from an inside perspective, what do you see as being those, number one, those challenges, and number two, what do you see as being the areas where an SIU can kind of capitalize on that push-pull?
Yeah, well, I think, and I've spoken about this on previous podcasts, so I don't want to rehash that, but being from my background, that was always really the goal when we would have meetings with the program safeguard carriers or the ZPICs or the UPICs. The investigators would work up their investigations in an effort to pitch them to us with the hopes that we would take the case, accept it, and work it criminally. So that's always been my mindset on how things are kind of supposed to work. And after retirement and working in the private sector, I'm seeing that that's not always the case. It's not the goal. And I'm sure every MCO or every SIU has a little bit of different balance on what they want as far as the resources. I mean, everybody probably wants recoveries for sure and referrals, but when you have to balance those resources, there's a push-pull or a give and take on what your end game is. So I think that's one of the main things is to have that communicated. It's like if I'm used to the law enforcement side where it's focused on referrals, that's fine. But if I'm working somewhere where that's not the focus, make sure I know that early on. So I can, you know, I'll do what you want, but I have to know what you want. So I think that's the main push-pull is people coming from different backgrounds in the SIUs that I've dealt with. You have some previous law enforcement that could be OIG or it could be local law enforcement or different from, they may be from different Medicaid broad control units. So you have a pretty wide variety of backgrounds. Generally, I think you could assume that everybody knows how to investigate things, but the mindset, the focus is probably going to be different for all those different backgrounds. And I think that's the main thing to make sure that everybody's really on the same page on what the goal, the SIU management, what is their goal?
So you brought up a good point, which is this whole discussion about resources, and it's about resource management and resource allocation. And resources aren't always people, right? It's technology, it's people make those two pieces of what those resources are. And it's not like SIUs have unlimited budgets and what have you. And so, Jason, I want to go over to you because, you know, obviously at the UPIC, you've got teams that do administrative actions, payment suspensions, and the like. You've got prepay teams, you've got postpay teams, you've got all of that. When you're sitting, you know, where you were at the Western UPIC, and you're trying to identify how to allocate those resources, what are some of the things that you're considering in determining how you're going to allocate the people, for example?
That's a good question. And I, since we're moving our direction and our focus here to, you know, to address things in special investigation units, I do want to preface that the Unified Program Integrity Contracts are basically very large SIUs. So a lot of the principles and dynamics that exist in that environment will also apply to SIUs. So, and then switching to a cooking metaphor, you know, so there are some basic principles in cooking, right? So it, things start a lot with carrots, onions, and celery. So it's really about identifying what your outcomes are expected to be, so what you're trying to produce, and then building processes and procedures that support them, because you want to always replicate the things that worked well and eliminate the things that are not working well. And then you want, when things are not working and the outcomes are not what you need to support your mission, then you need to be doing a root cause analysis to see, well, what needs to be changed. And I would say 9 times out of 10, it's going to boil down to communication and training. So those are the things that are going to make a special investigation unit successful.
Yeah, so, you know, the take home for me is that, and we've been saying this a lot, when people don't know what a UPIC is, right? So there are people at work in the fraud, waste, abuse space that just have never heard the term UPIC or ZPIC or whatever. And the example I always like to give is, well, it's the SIU for Medicare. And then people go, oh, okay. And they kind of understand that. So, you know, Matt, I want to go to you because you were an integral part of the, as Jason was, with the MCCs, right? We've talked about this on podcasts a number of times, this major case coordination. And obviously the focus in the CMS world is, at least within the contractors, is this collaboration, right? The Unified Program Integrity Contractors are, you know, when it was the ZPICs, the Zone Program Integrity Contractors, and prior to that, it was the Program Safeguard Contractors, and before that, it was just Benefit Integrity, where it was kind of just your own little microcosm of life, that the UPICs were created to kind of create this more wholesome group. It was also what, you know, also what spawned the unified case management system to create like one case manager. And that's what the MCC did. So there was this general ability to collaborate because it was all Medicare. And I think what we see in the SIU space is that there is a general reluctance to have the kind of collaboration that you would see in the MCC world that we see doesn't exist to the level. And there are organizations that foster collaboration, right? There were organizations and there were databases to work to foster that collaboration. But you would suspect that when there are organizations, there are some CMS-sponsored organizations that are private and commercial partnerships, right? There are just, you know, lobby groups and the like, but you don't necessarily see that level of collaboration that you see at the MCC level. There's this general reluctance. What do you attribute to some of that?
Well, even with the UPICs, it's somewhat of an insular collaboration. It is the federal government's, you know, community. It's DOJ, it's CMS, it's the US Attorney's Office, it's the OIG, at times the FBI and the UPICs. there's no commercial payers there. There's, you know, you don't get the, you know, postal inspection service or anybody else coming in to see if there's any commercial pay exposure to these things. So there, it's a little insular there. But what I attribute it to is just, I think it's just a mindset of we're taking care of our own, you know, and we've got our goals, we've got our expectations that we have to meet. So let's do that. And anything beyond that is kind of just a concept they haven't thought about yet. So, you know, you look at some of the MCOs for a large state like New York, New York Medicaid, they've got multiple MCOs working for them. If one MCO has a case on a provider, you know, and they find, you know, they have an overpayment or they even take action to remove them from the MCO, they don't communicate that on a normal basis with the other MCOs. And I think that's the type of thing that we really need to focus on. And I know here at Advise, we're putting together a work group to try to create a structure that will, you know, that we'll share with all of the payers that we can to come up with this type of collaboration where the impact of an action against a provider can be, you know, truly beneficial to all and, right, and be, you know, maximized. And because, you know, you might have two or three MCOs working on the same thing and they don't know it. So there's duplication of effort. There's all of those things. And those used to happen with the UPICs. If there was a national, a DME company or laboratory that crossed jurisdictional boundaries, sometimes there was more than one case open on them that neither of the UPICs knew the other one was working on it. And so the right. MCC solved a lot of that, and UCM is solving a lot of that in terms of just having access to the information. So there's steps in the right direction, but I still think there has to be a, you know, a change in mindset or a change in, you know, in the, I'm trying to think of the word, a change in mindset for the SIUs to understand that they're just a piece of the puzzle.
Right. Yeah, I mean, and part of what we're going to be doing here in that collaboration is really for the purposes more of getting plans, SIU plans, to just talk about how they run their SIU, process mm-hmm. improvement, not necessarily case sharing and things of that sort. Although one of the things that I know that we're doing, because we have a fairly large number of plans in one metropolitan geographic area, that if we have a case open on Dr. John Smith under Plan ABC, we're looking at the data for Dr. John Smith for Plan DEF mm-hmm. because it's in that same kind of regional area. And so, you know, we're essentially doing our own version of collaboration, right? Because we've got so many plans that are in a concentrated area that if we're seeing that provider is hitting one plan, they're probably hitting others. And so we're just going in and looking at the data. But yeah, the collaboration, I think, is always the challenge. The one thing that I've learned, and I saw this really specifically on a number of cases I had in New Jersey, was you know, if a plan had a potential $1 million in loss, a lot of times they weren't communicating to other plans, that provider being fraudulent, because every single time that you open up that door and that provider is involved in fraud, waste, or abuse, and there's a potential recovery or overpayment, you're expanding the amount of money, right? And it's, you know, I had a conversation with someone this morning where I said, it's not like the fraudsters are taking the money and putting it in a coffee can and putting it under their bed, waiting for someone to come and say, give me my money back, right? So, you know, if a plan has $1 million in exposure on loss amounts, another plan may have a similar amount of money as well. And there's only so much of the pot of money that's out there. So, you know, part of getting back to kind of when we talked about with Wade, this push-pull is I'm not going to show you my cards, because if I show you my cards, you're going to know how you're going to be betting in the future. And so, you know, I think I've used the term kind of colloquially with people is this lack of trust amongst SIUs. And I don't think it's really the right phrase. But I think that there's a, you know, going back to the insular nature that plans, you know, if they've identified a scheme, they kind of want to keep it to themselves, because in some regards, the ROI, the tangible piece of ROI is getting that money back. So Wade, I want to go back to you, because one of those push pulls is bringing in money versus making referrals. And, you know, one of the things that, you know, we're working hard with a lot of our plans is getting someone designated to be the law enforcement liaison for that plan, because then that person's job isn't inherently predicated upon the tangible recovery of money, right? And so, you know, where you've had a large focus where you are on getting out those referrals and that push-pull, where do you see that, you know, if we're talking about that kind of that push-pull in that is, you know, where do you see that benefit of kind of, we'll call it bifurcating some of the roles and responsibilities of people?
Well, I think first of all, you have to make sure that you have that, and it doesn't have to be a zero sum, like it's either referrals or recoveries, but I think initially the SIU has to decide, you know, what's most important and are they willing to carve out some resources for like one person, if the way you're describing it. So are we going to use the resources of one person strictly to work on referrals? And that's, there's a lot of pros and cons to that. But again, going back to what I said earlier, it's different people's experiences and expertise. Again, going back to the referrals, that was always kind of our goal. So that's kind of in the forefront in my mind. But if that's not important to the SIU, and it could be just because of the way they're critiqued or whatever, or what they consider ROI, but if it's strictly money, I don't think we will get buyback or buy into on that, because they don't want one whole, say, an FTE working on referrals. If that's not really important to them, they'd prefer that to be those resources spent on recoveries.
Yeah. Yeah. So Jason, I want to go back to you as we kind of wrap up, and then I'm going to give Matt the last word on this. But, you know, one of the things that is sort of a huge challenge in the SIU space is skill set development, right? There's in the SIU space, and you guys saw it at the UPIX, and Wade, you see it where you are, turnover of staff. Right. Everybody, there's usually a fair amount of turnover in a lot of SIUs. People jump from one plan to another for whatever personal, professional reasons, you know, that are out there. And I know in the UPIC world, when I was an agent, I would see that constantly. I would be dealing with one investigator at the UPIC on a case, and then all of a sudden I'm dealing with another and I'm dealing with another. And, you know, and look, you were my mentor and you gave me a lot of very strong foundations that allowed me to, you know, to grow in my job as an agent. And that was one of the strengths that you had. You mentored a lot of people. I mentored a lot of people. How do you account for the turnover and the ability to keep the SIU moving in the direction it needs to go when there are things like turnover, which then results in, who do you give your most complicated cases to? And how do you determine who your best resources are when you've got those kinds of issues?
I think it starts with the acquisition of a new person and having a structured onboarding environment where the important tasks, the important concepts are delineated very clearly in the onboarding documentation. A mentor or a supervisor, or both, depending on what the size of the organization is and its capability, its internal capabilities are signing off. Well, first of course, the individual is signing off that, yes, I've mastered that competency. And then someone who's in authority is acknowledging that, okay, good. And it should be the onboarding should be paced so that presumably the person has acquired those necessary concepts by the time that their probation has ended. And it gives the organization the ability to be more selective about having people that are truly ready for prime time and have the necessary basic skills to do what's needed to be done to achieve stated metrics. And that will offer a comfort to the new hire. I can tell you that that was something in the UPIC in the West, and that the former organization that I worked for, Clarent, it is a nicely structured onboarding environment, and it worked wonders in terms of getting the talent that was needed and keeping those people in place. Because what I've been brought in to look at process improvement in a number of organizations now since joining Avise back in September, I would say a lot of it is just there's a need for greater communication, especially with new people, so that they feel that they have the understanding to do it. Because if they don't have that comfort, the job market being what it is now, where there are organizations that will probably be able to pay more, there are organizations that maybe are more polished in terms of offering what the job is about or whatever else, that competition is going to scoop up anyone that isn't feeling well connected to the organization. And that isn't just, you know, donuts at a staff meeting. It's really about a comfort level that the operation is effective, efficient, and one that they understand.
Yeah, those are really great points. And I will go back and say I lied. I'm not going to give you the last word. I'm going to give Matt the last word, because one of the things that Matt, so we've been working on a bunch of these process improvement, SIU process improvement. And, you know, one of the things at OIG that we did a bunch of years ago, well before I retired, but, you know, certainly after Jason and you retired, was a formal mentoring program. You know, I had to go through a 2-day training. I had to do a functional equivalent of the Myers-Briggs, because the goal was to try to connect you with a new agent when we did large hirings that was going to be just a good fit, right, from a relationship perspective. And look, there are things that we can't account for, right? If you go to a plan that's going to pay you X dollars, and in 2 or 3 years you leave to another plan that's going to pay you X plus as a multiplier, you can't compete with that. But you certainly want to be able to be competitive within the SIU that you're being supportive and, you know, running through that. So Matt, I want to give you the very last word on this as we run out of time to just talk about, like, you know, when you've got a situation where you've got, and you were at the Northeast UPIC, which was equally as large, you're in really a densely populated area, is what do you see as being the biggest challenge in it's not the keeping of people, but it's keeping them engaged in understanding that as they become more experienced, you have to keep them engaged and interested in wanting to stay there. And it looks like I lost Matt. Apparently my question was so disheartening that
he didn't want to have the last word.
They didn't want to have the last word. So Jace, let me go back to you. So for the final word on this, we'll pivot back to you, is what do you see as being the couple things that are the most important pieces to keep people engaged in their growth and development as an SIU investigator?
It really, you know, I hate to be repetitive, but it's about communication and I would say training, but I don't just mean training, but it's that process improvement where there's a free and open environment for people to float suggestions about problems that they're experiencing in the process, or a form or a system that isn't, you know, commingling very well. That also is something that I've seen in several SIUs now over the past few months of doing process improvement, is that there's a lack of interoperability between systems. Sometimes it requires a special type of sign-in. People have to literally shut down. And that half hour it takes to go from one secure system to the next, it really puts a damper on someone's vim and vigor in terms of how they want to pace themselves in the production.
Yeah, hey, I'm back. That's a good point. Yeah, Matt, I figured that the question was so ominous for you that you had to log off, catch your breath, and come back. So I'm going to give you the last word in a second, but Jason, you're right. So that from a processing perspective, what you're talking about is the inability to have what they call the SSO, single sign-on, right? Get into one system, do your work, get out, that you're spending all this time logging in, logging out. It really does become a frustration for people. So, Matt, I want to go to you for the very last word, as long as you aren't going to get, you know, freaked out over my question. But just from an internal kind of retention perspective, how do you keep people engaged with one? You know, I enjoyed being an OIG. I enjoyed healthcare for it. We enjoy it. That's why we stayed in the space. You know, Jason's been in the space for well over 30 years. You, Wade, we've been here a long time. We were engaged because we enjoyed it. It's also the fact that Jason and I also dress the same, and that's part of it. But what do you see? And you're doing a lot of process improvement stuff as well. Yep. You came in and rewrote most of the policies and procedures at UPIC Northeast for process improvement. What are the things that keep people engaged?
What keeps people engaged is knowing what their jobs are, knowing what the expectations are, being given the tools that allow them to achieve those, you know, expectations. And on a manager's point of view, it's knowing what the capabilities are of your people, knowing your people, what motivates them. Is it public praise? Is it money? Is it just a private slap in the back? It's understanding what those, you know, what your people want, and then giving them the tools to achieve their job, making sure they understand what their jobs are. And I can tell you, it's not easy, because expectations, especially if you have a payer like CMS, those expectations change daily. We talk about MCC. Prior to MCC, it was more like Horizon, or where everything was supposed to be, you know, no referrals, just get the money back. MCC kind of brought the balance back to that. So all of those expectations changed. The people's jobs changed because of that. It's communicating that. It's, again, giving them the tools, giving them, and Jason's right, onboarding the right people, understanding them when they come on board. Here's what you're going to be doing. What is your skill set? How do you, you know, how do you want to be motivated? All of that goes into play, and you got to multiply the difficulty of that by the COVID factor, where everybody's remote now. Doing that kind of training and mentoring that is necessary, now it's twice as difficult, because sometimes it might be years before you even meet the people, other than on the phone or through a video conference. Right. It makes it doubly tough.
Yeah, so I think really what you're saying is talking about, really, at the end of the day, it's managing the expectations of the person. You know, and the example I always like to give is, you know, if you spent, talking about the OIG, if you spent 10 or 15 years at the Secret Service doing threat and protective intelligence, and then you come over to HHS OIG as a senior agent, you cannot be expected to operate at the same cadence as someone like me, who spent 20 years as a field agent. If you don't even know what a CPT code is, right, how could you be expected to operate at a tempo that someone who's been in the space for 20 or 25 years operates? So it is. And that gets back to kind of Wade's issue, is this push-pull, right? Like, what are the expectations? Someone who spent 20 or 30 years in, you know, in this lane, and now they're in this lane, there's an expectation management. And I think that becomes a challenge, particularly when you've got an SIU where you've got a huge amount of turnover. You don't really necessarily have that ability to ramp people up or whatever. So it's a lot to digest. I actually think, having now been on this side for the past 4 years, and now you guys are seeing it, I actually think that the management of SIUs is probably one of the most complicated things to do. Because it is, the mission changes, the focus changes, the expectations change, the people, the turnover that I see in the SIU space is something I've never thought. You know, we had the same employer for 20, 30 years. For Matt and Jason, you guys had two employers for very long periods of time. You know, you just kind of stayed where you are, and that's not really the focus. So it's a lot to digest. And I think, you know, over the next few weeks, we're going to continue to unpack these discussions, because they really are, I think, challenges for SIU. So as always, guys, these are great conversations. We could probably talk for hours about it. And we can go on. Next week, I will expect that we will all have the same T-shirt on, because I think, you know, Jason and I are starting a trend. It'll be T-shirts. And then I'm hoping that you guys will all adopt the haircut I have. Matt, I expect you to have some facial hair next week, because Wade and Jason and I. So it's going to be an evolution. We'll see where it goes.
Start taking that Nugenics stuff that Doug Flutie takes. I'll work on it.
Exactly. So as always, Wade, Matt, Jason, good to see you guys. Thank you again for tuning into our podcast again. This comes out every Friday with our newsletter. If you're not getting our newsletter, please let us know. Hello, H-E-L-L-O, @advizeadvizehealth.com. Get our newsletter weekly. Tune into our podcasts, our LinkedIn lives. You can get all of our stuff on our YouTube channel as well. Just go up on the YouTube and search. We'll see you at the next LinkedIn Live. We'll see you at the next podcast. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you all.
Thank you.